Good afternoon. This is Michael Blaze. You're listening and viewing Echoes of Blackness. We're here at Skid Row Studios, and we appreciate your viewing and your support. Echoes of Blackness primarily is designed to look into the activities and the views of people who've been working to make a difference in this country, not only for Black people, but period, just trying to make a difference as activists, going through certain changes, exposing themselves to certain scrutinies. And so tonight, we'll really get into that real hard. We have with us a former Black Panther member, former SNCC member from back in the day, Mr. Henry Hank Jones.
Hi.
Who began as a Panther in San Francisco.
Yes.
In the Bay Area, up north, where you can still see the stars. So tell us a little bit about what we're going to get into today, Hank.
Well, we're going to talk about, the history of struggle generally. We're going to talk about the my involvement with the, first of all, organizing with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was not a member. I was too old. You know, I didn't trust anybody over 30, and I was like almost 29 when I started working with them. And then joining the Black Panther Party for self-defense and, to bring it on up to
Before we go forward, I do a lot of research, and I read yours is similar to Mr. Comrade Deacon Alexander, who was supposed to be here today, who's not. Mm-hmm. And he made the same statement. His first impression, his first real motivation was Emmett Till. So why don't we start with Emmett Till for the generation nowadays that may not be up on what it really means to be lynched, which is a lot more than Hollywood, just get a tree and hang you. It's very, very involved.
Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black youth that was visiting his uncle in Money, Mississippi in 1955, and he was accused of insulting a white woman disrespecting a white woman by whistling at her. He was from Chicago, and of course his mother had warned him about how to act in the segregated South, especially Mississippi, where the Klan was prominent, and there was always danger of something could happen to you. Mm-hmm. Well, he was accused of whistling at a white woman, and her husband and brother-in-law, I think, came to his uncle Moses Wright's home in the early morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were looking for Emmett Till. And they pulled him out of the house and took him off and tortured him over several hours in different locations before finally splitting his head open with an axe.
Burning
him and...
lynching is very involved. Right. It's not just hanging someone at all.
People heard the screams, in different locations, but no one came to his aid. They took him and then finally shot him, and after several hours of torture and all, and then weighted his body down with a industrial fan and threw him in one of the rivers. And the body eventually surfaced, and Emmett's mother, Mamie, was wise enough to have an open casket so the world could see what they had done to her child. We got the pictures. I was a Marine stationed in Japan in 1955. We got the Jet magazine with the photo of the before and after photo of Emmett. And after they done with Emmett, and he was unrecognizable as a human being. It was like a big bloated mass of flesh with one eyeball sticking out of it, and just hideous. And that was the thing that outraged me most. I think that was the most outrageous thing that I had witnessed in my lifetime.
Okay, so now we can move forward. I just wanted, people in this generation may not understand clearly what lynching is. Mm-hmm. Often it's a group participation, even with people taking pictures near the mangled body. And, you know, it's like sport,
yeah.
You know, like just way too deep. But any event, so we'll move forward now.
Okay. And, well, once we saw the pictures, it changed my whole life. You know, it changed my life where I began to question what I was doing in another people's country, supposedly bringing democracy to them when I didn't have it at home. My people couldn't even vote. We were still being strictly segregated in the South, and, you know, going to back doors, getting off the sidewalks for white folks, not looking them in the face and directly in the eyes and things like this. We were under Klan terror. But after Emmett, all that changed for me. We immediately, there were like 13 or 14 blacks in my company, and we immediately began to desegregate everything around us. And that meant we'd had to fight. If we went into a place and we were denied access, well, we decided that no one would have access, and so we would shut the place down. And eventually we, after about a year, that we could go wherever we wanted. Of course, we went to the places we always went to. We just didn't want to be denied, you know.
Yeah.
And because of the color of our skins. Yeah. And so I got out the Marine Corps and came back to San Francisco and started school, met my first wife and started a family. I was had just finished 2 years of junior college, and a fella came and knocked on my door, and he was a SNCC organizer, and told me they were getting ready to bus my kids to the white suburbs, and did I know anything about it? And I didn't, and so I went to a meeting and started working with SNCC to. We couldn't stop busing because it was federally mandated, but we demanded two-way busing. If you're going to bus our kids to the suburbs, bus yours to the inner city. And then we'd be ensured that the schools would improve. So that was our issue around the schools. And then from that point on, I organized around all kinds of issues with SNCC, and I did that for about 4.5 years. And you know, we organize our demonstrations.
Tell people who was the head of SNCC and some of the SNCC function as sort of an organizer beyond itself also, I believe. Why don't we share some of that?
Yeah, at that time, Stokely Carmichael was had just become head of SNCC, and we brought him to San Francisco to raise funds for Mississippi Freedom Summer, and took him to those suburbs and set him down in living rooms, and he would tell the stories of the horror stories about what people were being subjected to in the South, and they would support, you know, they would write checks or they would provide legal services or whatever they could do, you know, the rich white people. And so, and then of course, eventually Stokely would come around every 6 months or so, you know, and eventually came around and we were talking about Black Power, you know, and that was a game changer for SNCC, you know, Black Power. We stopped so much focusing on mainstream political organizing and started talking about you know, self-determination and, you know, and doing stuff for ourselves as black folks. And so that eventually, you know, after the frustrating 4.5 years of organizing, organizing, trying to make some gains that way and recognizing that the system, it was systemic, the racism was systemic, and the system was the problem. The Black Panther Party was created in October of 1966. And at that time in San Francisco, we were in discussions about creating a Black Panther Party of Northern California.
Let's also explain to people very quickly that the Black Panther Party spread throughout the world and not just in Los Angeles or San Francisco, but spread all over.
It had global exposure. We even had a international section in Algeria that was linking up with all revolutionary organizations around the world. Mm-hmm. Black Panther Party began, you know, concerned with the upliftment of black people primarily, who were being oppressed and brutalized by the police, who appeared to us to be occupying forces in our community and not there to serve and protect us, but to keep the lid on, to suppress us. But after the so-called invasion of the state capital, the Black Panther Party got national and worldwide recognition. You know,
but let's clarify that invasion briefly.
The Black Panther Party was going to Sacramento to protest a bill that was they were going to pass, the Mulford Act, that would prevent us from openly bearing arms. Mm. And openly bearing arms was a constitutional right at the time and still is, you know. But then when the Black Panther Party started doing it to defend the community, it became a major issue and a problem. So they quickly, legislators in Sacramento got together quickly to pass this bill, the Mulford Act, that would prevent the party from openly bearing arms. And so that's why they went to some of the leadership and some members went to Sacramento to protest that. And I wanted to go, but I could not because I couldn't figure out who was going to feed my family if I lost my job. But and I had a full-time job, because I had to have one. But then the party, you know, as I said, from that act, the party became known throughout the world. And, party chapters sprung up all over the country so rapidly that you really couldn't control it, you know. It's like grass fire, you know. They just started everywhere. In every state,
and primarily the activities were feeding and looking out for children and community.
We had a 10-point platform and program. The Black Panther Party began by polling the people to determine what their needs were, and designing a program to meet those needs: land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and those were survival programs that we came with. You know, we did sickle cell anemia treatment programs. We did the breakfast program, which I think the powers that be, the status quo, feared the most. They feared that more than they did the guns, because we were winning the hearts and minds of the people, liberating the people. So they quickly designed something called COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program.
Well, we're also going to show that first clip now, have Jeremy show that first one. And this will show that there are some consequences that a number of you had to be exposed to, and we'll explain more about the COINTEL after we view this clip.
The police in our communities were like an occupying force there to protect the property of outside interests, not to serve and protect the people in the community. The Black Panther Party took up the challenge and started patrolling the police to ensure that people understood their constitutional rights, just their rights in general, and to
Jeremy,
make sure that
how much time do
people
I have
weren't being brutalized by the police.
When I joined the Black Panther Party in 1968, my first experience with COINTELPRO was the assassination of Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and John Huggins in Los Angeles. I never carried a gun before until Bunchy Carter, John Savage, and Sylvester Bell, until they got killed. I never carried a gun. I didn't have no use for a gun. I was functioning in the community. I was working free breakfast programs. I was working clothing drives, you know, organizations with people in the community and the church. I need no gun.
All right, so that was a clip, and we'll show another.
The involvement with the Panther Party brought me in direct conflict with Hoover and his program, COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program that was designed to destroy dissent in this country.
Okay.
It was specifically geared toward preventing the rise of what he called the black messiah. The climate in the country, to me, is much like it was back in the 70s, the late 60s, the early 70s. It's designed to squash any form of dissent. If you're not going along with the program, then you're a problem. Some of us have taken the stand that we consider that whatever the consequence, we're not going to cave into this.
All right, so I'm going to let you continue. I want to say thank you. I used a few clips from Legacy of Torture. It's about a half an hour show. You viewers and listeners should try to take a good look at the full version. These are just clips.
Yes, it's on YouTube. It can be viewed there. We were just getting out of jail in San Francisco County Jail when that was made, that Legacy of Torture. And that was in 2005. We had been locked up for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury.
Well, let's go back to 1971,
3? 70,
yes. Let's start there, though, and okay. Then we'll come up to how they came back.
All right. 1971, there was a police killing in South San Francisco, and the two lead detectives on that case began to investigate different organizations, and I guess through a process of elimination, they focused on the Black Panther Party eventually, drew up a list of names and labeled those people on that list BLA members, Black Liberation Army members. And my name was on that list, and some of the other members of the San Francisco 8 were on that list. And they began to, you know, a real effort to prosecute us for that police killing. And so this happened around the time that Fred Hampton was murdered. And we had to get out of San Francisco because the repression had come down so severely. They were kicking down our doors, raiding our offices. They were killing us in our sleep, like Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago. And so we all feared that for our families and stuff. So we had to get away from our families. We had a choice. You could either give up the struggle or you could take a stand. And those who took a stand knew that their lives were in jeopardy. So we went under, you know, went on the run. And ended up, some of us, in New Orleans in 1973. And some of the brothers were caught up in a sweep of about 13 people in New Orleans, some from the community, some who were former Panthers or who were currently Panthers at that time. Mm-hmm. And put in jail. Three members of the party, the Black Panther Party, that were on that list that those two lead detectives on that San Francisco police killing case came to New Orleans and oversaw the torture of those three Panthers. They were tortured over the course of several days. The youngest was Reuben Scott. I think Reuben was about 19, and they eventually broke Reuben through the torture, and he was cooperating with them. And then they tortured Harold Taylor and John Bowman over the course of several days, and they eventually had to give in to the torture. You can only, resist torture for so long, you know.
We're going to show a little additional clip, but first, let's explain for our viewers and listeners a little more about this COINTELPRO thing.
Yeah, COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO, which, as far as I know, began like in the 20s.
It did.
With Paul Laurence Dunbar and
Marcus
Garvey, and all the way up to Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and of course the Panthers. So we don't want people thinking this was something designed just for the Panthers, but it was designed for anyone that had charisma and was able to influence other blacks, I think.
Yeah, the specific goal was to prevent the rise of a black messiah, according to J. Edgar Hoover, who created COINTELPRO.
And just tell them how it worked, like much like the art of war, get inside.
Yeah. Infiltration with informants or agent provocateurs. Agent provocateurs are the ones who would get inside your organization and try to encourage you to commit illegal acts so they could set you up for
drugs.
Right, yeah, drugs. And letter-writing campaigns, anonymous letter-writing campaigns, where you would use the name of one member of the party and address it to another or another organization and make false accusations, and create dissent and confusion in that way and animosity. So, black jacketing, which was like labeling someone an informant, this was done to also create suspicion and confusion and divide us and create dissension in the ranks. And it was used against Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, the leadership of the Black Panther Party, to create dissension in the ranks.
All right. Well, why don't we show that other roll in, and then we'll discuss it, because, just saying torture is one thing, but this is a bit more graphic and, and it's personal. These are the people that actually experienced being tortured, right? Yeah. So play that for me, Jeremy.
In 1973, 13 alleged members of the Black Panther Party were arrested in New Orleans. Various detectives from police departments in other parts of the country immediately flew to New Orleans to participate in the interrogation of some of the arrestees.
We were taken to the New Orleans City Police Department.
I was put in a jail cell and questioned by different jurisdictions.
Without asking me any questions, they commenced beating me. They beat me, they punched me, they kicked me, they spit on me.
They called me a lot of vile names. And then they told me that they was gonna kill me if I didn't cooperate with them. Then they came out with this cattle prod.
Torture has an ugly connection with United States history, at least dating back to slavery. In the 60s and 70s, particularly against the Black Panther Party, beatings and interrogation, forms of torture were being used against members of the Black Panther Party primarily. And what happened in 1973 in New Orleans is one example.
30 years later, I find that nothing has actually changed. I'm being faced with charges from 30 years ago, and actually with the same people that were charging me and accusing me of this 30 years ago. And actually what I see is that Homeland Security is actually an extension of COINTELPRO, which according to the government was illegal and unconstitutional.
The same people who tried to kill me in 1973 are the same people who are here today, 2005, trying to destroy me. I mean it literally.
No, I will never cooperate with these people under any circumstances, especially since they're criminals. These are the persons. They should be investigated. They should be locked up for what they did in New Orleans to my friends.
Whatever the consequence, we're not going to cave into this.
All right, so there's our final clip from this great film. You can get on YouTube, Legacy of Torture, The War Against the Black Liberation Movement. And our special guest in studio today is Henry Hank Jones. And I'm reading my notes here, and it says in 2005, they came back at you again. Well, first of all, I think the whole thing was thrown out because of the torture back in the 70s. Then 2005, mm-hmm. It says you went to jail for a period of time. Why don't you bring us up on that?
Yeah, actually, 2005 was we went to jail for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury, but we were only incarcerated until that grand jury expired, which amounted to, about, in my case, about 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. 2007, though, is when they rounded us all up, and we were locked up for about 9 months in the county jail until we could make, some of us could make bail, you know. And eventually, you know, they had no case. The grand jury was a secret grand jury. It was an investigative grand jury, not an indicting grand jury, which meant that they were trying to develop a case against us, and they wanted us to help them do it. Because when you're brought before a grand jury, if you don't cooperate, the consequence is that you can be incarcerated. So they have that threat, that intimidating threat over your head when you go in there. So if you refuse, like we did, you get locked up. So, but in 2007, they came with arrest warrants and locked six of us up. Two were already locked up on a separate case. Mm-hmm. And everyone was brought to San Francisco County Jail to serve the time. Six of us were eligible for, to make bail.
How much was the bail? Ransom. I know it was probably outrageous.
Well, eventually it leveled off at $3 million apiece for everybody. But it started out, they were talking $10 million for me and another brother, and then it was $5 million for me and another brother, and the judge finally just leveled everything off. At $3 million, of course, I didn't have that kind of pocket change. So, but that meant we couldn't come up with the bail. We were going to remain in jail until the case was resolved. So, but we had gone across the country in 2005 after that grand jury jailing and told our story to different audiences around the country and built up support. And so when they came in 2007 and locked us up, we had people. I had two white ladies I had never laid eyes on in my life before put up their homes to bail me out, along with my own wife, you know. And so that's how I was able to get out of jail. And, of course, we went immediately back to organizing around the country, telling the story of COINTELPRO, the torture, the Homeland Security USA Patriot Act, and the abuses of government officials, you know.
When was COINTELPRO discovered? Seemed to me like that was also in 71. 71. Broke in and...
It was 71, the burglary, and that's...
Burglary.
There's a book out now called The Burglary and a film called 1971 about the book. And it should be premiering around here pretty soon. And, I've seen it. It's a good good piece.
Well, tell us a little bit about what this act, someone actually went and found these papers hidden, or...
Yeah, peace activists. One was had been a freedom rider, a white man, John, had been a freedom rider, one of the first freedom riders. Yeah. And, you know, he's a college professor, professor of theology. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Bonnie, she's a housewife, had three kids herself. But there were eight of them. And they all devised this plan to go in and destroy draft records in Media, Pennsylvania, the FBI office, you know. And they ran across these files. They went in and they took all the files they could find, and they put them in bags and brought them out of there. They were going to destroy them. They ran across, they were going through them, and they ran across this word, COINTELPRO, on one of the files. And that's where it all started. And they didn't really realize what they had had until they started investigating. And then they gave this information to Betty Metzger, who was a reporter with the Washington, the Washington Post, I think. But she was a reporter. And she was the only one that was able to get it into print. Other people either, you know, they never received it. It was shortstop somehow or another. But it got to Betty, and she was able to get it printed. And that exposed COINTELPRO for the first time. And, you know, and it was eventually, you know, there was an eventual congressional hearing committee on COINTELPRO, and they designated it, determined that it was unconstitutional, illegal, and but no one ever was really prosecuted for it. For what they did, for the murders, for the frame ups, for what they did, any of the illegal activity, no one was ever prosecuted. The FBI gets away with this kind of stuff. You know, I don't think any FBI agent's ever gone to jail for any illegal activity, but that's. And the abuse of power that still is ongoing.
Okay. I want to speak more on it, but it really requires additional time that we no longer have. Mm-hmm. And I do want to touch upon a couple of other points, like the book you were showing me there, for instance, yes. Some of the fallen warriors. But we'll talk about that now.
Okay. This is a book. It's called
Hold it up.
Over 800 Years in Captivity.
Yeah, right there.
Okay, and it's about Panther political prisoners, and We called them victims of COINTELPRO because for various reasons they've been incarcerated. The longest one, I guess, is Romaine Chip Fitzgerald, who was incarcerated in 1969. So he's going on 45 years and in captivity. And as I say, they're victims of COINTELPRO operations. We were, Black Panther Party was about trying to serve its people, you know, doing something the government should have been doing. People who had been disenfranchised, marginalized, ignored, oppressed, you know.
Disenfranchised, that's a word that no longer exists.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what it means. Go ahead, though.
Yeah, you can't, no vote. You could not vote.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you had no representatives in government to yeah. vote for, really. There,
yeah.
there were no Black legislators, law, you know.
Yeah.
So, but these brothers here, we're fighting to get them released. Right now, I think there's about 17 left. Some have died in captivity. Others are you know, still suffering. They're in their 60s and 70s, and the health is getting, you know, there are some severe cases of health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And
so, what can people do? You say this is promotional?
Yes.
Well, you want raising funds?
We're raising funds with these books. I have some. I don't know how the general public can access me.
They can contact me or us right here at Skid Row Studios.
All right.
Echoes of Blackness.
All right. That's fine. And I will have these books on sale. There are also T-shirts. And what we do with the money is put money on the books for the political prisoners. That we do we support their families, and you know, people can't. Some of their families can't even afford to bury them. You know, so we do things like that with this money.
Now I want to say I've come to a couple of the monthly meetings, and what is that? Simply Wholesome.
Yes.
So we want to give a shout out for Simply Wholesome. It's a great business about health foods and all kind of juices. You can go there and have meetings, plenty of parking right on Slauson, and they're committed to the community in every way possible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good for your spirit, your body, and your soul. That's Simply Wholesome. So when I went there, though, with Deacon Alexander, I'm thinking, well, these gentlemen are up in age, and they're probably just kicking it, you know, talking about the things they used to do. And I discovered every one of you there was involved with a different positive project right now in 2015. And that's when I decided not to do the film and to do this podcast so I could get to know you better and come up on what are some of the activities going on. Like, I noticed you guys raising money for people, important things that were going on, different activities. Tell us a little bit about the function of the Black Panther, the former Black Panthers now.
Well, like you say, we're engaged in various different projects, you know, homeless people, Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter, yes. Yeah.
Black Lives Matter has, you know, I'm very excited about that because I think it has potential to become a serious national movement. It's Black Lives Matter resulted from the murder of Mike Brown and just blanked on the brother in New York. But police killings, and it's, to me, it's this generation's Emmett Till moment. You know, and there is a serious awakening among our youth that they're beginning to stand up and take action to protect themselves and demand, make some demands about changes in how they're treated by the authorities. And I just hope that we can keep that going, and it grows and becomes a national movement again, because we definitely need another movement today.
Well, you know, I sort of jumped ahead of a lot of other things we were talking about, but what are your feelings on the so many people have been affected by this, you know, COINTELPRO?
Yes.
That what did you think once a judge discovers that this activity is going on and you've been set up, why they won't just let these people go?
Because they represent...
You've been set up. It's clear. It's written. It's documented. You've been set up. You've been had. And we're throwing you in jail or we're trying to kill you or whatever. But now that it's out in the open, why aren't there mass reversals?
Because there's a fear of the influence that they might have on this current generation, for example. It's their politics. They're being held because of their beliefs. And people like Mumia is a good example. You know, Mumia is a journalist, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are afraid to let him go because of the impact he might have out here on the streets. And for no other reason, because if they had just committed the basic murder, you know, they would have been eligible for parole long ago and probably on the streets. But no, they're being held because of their beliefs. And that's why they're political prisoners. It's the politics.
The global politics?
The global and national politics, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's political prisons all over right now.
That's right.
What I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And do you think they're all being done pretty much the same way, just set up and infiltrated? And, you know, I mean, do you think that's what is happening all around the world now, these same principles?
Yeah, I think it is, because those in power are trying to hold on to it at any cost. And anybody that, you know, what they fear in this country is most, I think, is a breakout of democracy, you know, real and true democracy. A participatory democracy.
Right? When people became Black Panthers back in the day, what were some of the prerequisites? What were some of the basic principles they had to try to adhere to?
Well, you know, we had the 10-point platform and program, you know, and I joined the Black Panther Party because it was serving the people. Mm-hmm. And this was my fundamental motivation. I wanted to serve the people. I was doing that with SNCC, you know. But the Black Panther Party was doing it in a more programmatic manner and nationally, you know, because of the notoriety they had gotten from the Sacramento so-called invasion. And so... it just made sense not to try to keep trying to duplicate actions and join forces with something like the Black Panther Party. And they were actually implementing programs to do these things. And so you just had to have a love for the people. You had to be selfless, you know, not be so concerned about your own life. Because when you join the party, you kind of assume that you probably wouldn't survive that anyway. But you joined it to serve the people. You joined it because you love the people.
How do people continue when all your friends and people around you are being shot down like the buffalo? How do you continue? I mean, at the time, you didn't realize you were up against all the feds in the world, did you?
No.
And you all were like, well, maybe not you, but they were like, what, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. So it seems to me like there was something going on in the darkness against them that they were actually surviving without even knowing how sinister it was.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always compared what we were up against with what our ancestors were up against in slavery. And I can't imagine anything worse than that, you know. And they survived that. So, you know, we could survive this. We can survive anything, you know. If we can survive slavery, we can survive anything.
What is the connection in your mind for let's talk about George Jackson. Mm-hmm. What role do you think he played in the Black Power movement?
George Jackson was organizing in the prisons. He was a field marshal, you know, Black Panther Party. He was organizing the prison movement, you know, laying that foundation. And, you know, he was converted in prison, you know, George. So that gave hope for other prisoners, you know. You didn't have to remain victimized. You could become proactive, you know, even behind those walls, you know. And he set that example. And this is why they had to get rid of him. He was a very powerful brother.
Yeah, I was taken in his book, Solidaire Brothers, at the end, where he's saying, well, you know, they're about to kill me, but it's good, and blah, blah, blah. Right? I'm like, well, you know they're about to kill you? Like, wow.
Well, Malcolm knew he was going to be killed. King knew he was going to be killed, you know. There are sacrifices you have to make.
Do you think there's a difference between revolutionary and activist?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, activism, revolution is, to me, the ultimate form of activism, you know, because you're talking about a complete change, you know. And in this country, I think that's what we need. We need that. This system is designed to preserve itself. And if it is corrupt and if it is racist and if it is inhumane, then it's not going to correct itself. So you have to do something to bring about a complete change in that, you see.
I also want to go over something that Deacon Alexander mentioned to me during one of our interviews, which was the gentleman that runs the Pan-African Film Festival, Babu. Mm-hmm. He tells me that back in the 70s, he used to bring films even then to impress people's minds, right? Liberation films. Indeed. And I thought that was deep that he would go on to do the Pan-African Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And so during that, they just had a presentation to Black Panthers. Why don't you address that a little bit, the film that so many people rave about that just came out?
Yes, it's called...
And was featured at the Pan-African Film Festival.
Yes, it's called The Black Panthers... Vanguard of the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very honest film about what went on within the Black Panther Party, and it even addresses the conflicts and divisions within the Black Panther Party. And it's a lesson. It should be viewed as a teaching to a lesson for today's activists, you know.
Applying what?
Applying what you learn from that to your present situation so that you don't make the same mistakes that we made. We made mistakes.
Like?
Absolutely. The leadership of the Black Panther Party was a major mistake to get caught up in personal issues, you know, and ego conflicts and things, and forget some of your basic principles. And that set a bad example for the general population, the progressive movement.
What about drugs? What about, do you feel that drugs were used to also help to destroy the Black Panthers?
Oh, absolutely. And that was one of the things that we started out trying to get rid of, was drugs, you know. And eventually, you know, the leadership of Huey Newton got hooked on drugs, you know, and led to his demise ultimately, you know.
But I don't think by accident.
No, it wasn't by accident. I don't feel at all it was by accident. It was orchestrated. And I know what Huey was like before he went to prison, and I know what he was like when he came out, and he was two different people.
touch upon that. We got a few minutes. Touch upon that. Because a lot of people know of him but didn't know him.
Well, I never, you know, hung out with him or anything. Mm-hmm. I just know the person that I saw, you know, confront the police in the streets and, you know, protect the community and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. You know, he was Minister of Defense, so, and he played that role very well. You know, mm-hmm. he set a mean example. You know, he was a fearless brother, you know.
Yeah.
And would lay down his life for his people. Mm-hmm. And then when he came out of prison, that was gone, kind of. You know, mm-hmm. it's a different person. Mm-hmm. And one can only assume that something was done to him when he was in there, you know.
Well, we're rolling down to about 3 or 4 minutes. And one of the things that I want to do is thank some of our past guests on this show. Like Robert Lee Johnson was on. He did a magnificent piece, and want to remind people about his book on Compton and the Images of America. Get to it in Amazon. And we had Michael D. McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And he was so energized and so global and so open about the truths of his life that, you know, the storytelling and all that was just a great thing to see. But he also reflected back to that time with, I think, Fred Hampton.
Fred Hampton.
And it was just, he was like, you know, he was only 19, you know. Like, wow, we didn't really realize they were going to kill us, yeah. You know, so.
Well, the average age of a party member was like 17 to 20
years old,
you know. So yeah. They were kids. I was older.
Yeah. You know? We're not going to touch upon your age. I looked at something that said in 2005 how old you were. I was like, really?
Well, if my eyes open on July 28th, I'll be 80.
Yeah, I was like, really? I wasn't even going to say that because people would never even think that at this point. So what else? So what do you look forward to in the future of the Black Panther, former Black Panther, once a Panther, always a Panther, but what do you look forward in the future in toward of impact on America?
Well, you know, we represent the history, you know, and, of our struggle, and we owe it to our youth. And I tell them all the time that my value to them is, you know, my experiences and, you know, that in the struggle. And so, I go around and try to fill in that gap of our history that's been hidden from them. And that was not by accident. That was by design. Mm-hmm. Once they took the progressive movement out in the 70s, and it broke you know, a link in the chain of our struggle. Mm-hmm. And then they proceeded to dumb down succeeding generations. And so
what does that mean? Hold on.
They don't have a knowledge of the history of our struggle. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I mean, when I go to campuses and stuff to talk to students, they're just kind of blown away. They don't have this knowledge.
Yeah.
And I'm more than happy to bring it, you know.
Oh yeah.
Because I, you know, how do you know where you're going if you don't know where you came from, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm very optimistic about the current generation. They're very sharp. They're very quick. They just need the foundation. They need to know their history.
Yeah.
And particularly the history of our struggle in this country, the Black folks from slavery on, you know.
The whole thing of slavery, oh, we're down to 14 seconds, so I guess I ought to say, hey, this is Blaze from Echoes of Blackness, and our special guest today has been Henry Hank Jones, former member of the Black Panthers, and even today a committed activist for the struggle of human rights all through the world. Blaze out.